KTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. We welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I've been combing the morning show archives in search of past morning show interviews that I thought might be soothing and fun and interesting to listen to. And I came across an interview from 2012 that I think really fits the bill perfectly. It's an interview that is with the editor of a new edition of the autobiography of one of America's most distinctive and unique geniuses, Mark Twain. Here is that interview. Enjoy. I'm sure many of you are aware of the enormous attention attracted to a literary release not long ago of the autobiography of Mark Twain. Yes, Samuel L. Clemens, who died over a century ago, and so such a thing seems on the surface to be utterly preposterous. And the world has seen some of the autobiography of Mark Twain, which over which he labored in sort of fits and starts over the course of many years of his life. But Mr. Twain, Mr. Clemens, stipulated that the autobiography should not be released to the public in its entirety for a century after his death. And so we are just now seeing much of this writing for the very first time. It is the loving, painstaking work of the Mark Twain Project that makes this publication possible. And I am so pleased and honored to be able to speak today on the morning show with Bob Hurst, who has been general editor of the Mark Twain Project for many years, for several decades, in fact, and he studied English and American literature at the University of California, Berkeley, and then worked on the Mark Twain Project, I believe, back in his graduate school days, and eventually signed on there, and is general editor, and so bears much of the responsibility for the enormous task of drawing all of these sort of scraps, all the sort of various attempts which Mark Twain made to write some sort of autobiography, of drawing all of this material together and presenting it to the public in some coherent form. And he and his colleagues have managed that feat quite successfully, and it is so good to have this book now in hand, published by the University of California Press, Berkeley. And again, this is volume one of the autobiography of Mark Twain. And Bob Hurst, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Could you tell us first a little bit about your initial exposure, your initial encounter with the writings of Samuel L. Clemens, Mark Twain?
Sure. I was a graduate student at Berkeley in English, American literature, and I lost my job as a TA because I wasn't moving fast enough toward a degree, so I had to go get a job. And it just so happened that the Mark Twain papers were starting to publish, and they were advertising for proofreaders and checkers. Although I'd never proofread anything or checked anything, I'd applied for a job and got one and basically learned how to edit and learned all about the papers as I went through graduate school. And by the time I had gotten my degree and went off to UCLA to teach for a couple of years, I was ready to be the general editor as soon as anybody gave me a chance, and that's what I got in 1980.
And here you are all these years later, and what a thrilling time to be at the helm of the
absolutely.
Mark Twain Project.
No, it's been very exciting, absolutely.
Before we talk about what the Mark Twain Project has been busy doing, even before the release of this autobiographical material, I wonder if you could sketch for our listeners a summary of who Samuel L. Clemens was, Mark Twain, because I think this is one of those names that almost all of us immediately and easily recognize, and yet when it comes down to when exactly did he live, what exactly did he do, what exactly was his significance, I think a lot of Americans can't answer those questions or fill in the blanks as well as we should.
Right. Well, I don't know if I can give you a full biography in the time we have, but basically, four or five kids and parents in a little town called Florida. At the age of four, he moved to a town called Hannibal, and he grew up on the Mississippi River, going to school there for a while, but then apprenticed by his mother to a typesetter. And from that point on, he's off and running in a way that basically takes him through a variety of apprenticeships, he says. Basically, I have a lifetime of made up of apprenticeships, one trying one thing and trying another. He does eventually become a pilot on the river. That'll be 1857 when he starts his apprenticeship. The Civil War, which starts in 1861, closes the river, so he loses that job, and he has to go basically west with his brother Orion, who's going to be Secretary of the Nevada Territory. And he gets out there and gets bitten by the silver fever, as he says, tries to make a killing in the mines, doesn't succeed, and finally has to take a real job, which is basically a reporter for a newspaper. And it's from that point on that he's really doing quite a lot of writing as a reporter. He develops a reputation as one of the funniest reporters they've got. His humor is always in the foremost part of what he's doing. But he never really intends to make writing a career until about 1865, when he's almost 30. And he's sort of backed down into that career because he's run out of money, and he's in San Francisco, and he needs to do something to support himself. And from that point on, 1865, he publishes The Jumping Frog and then publishes a variety of books, the first one being Innocence Abroad in 1869. And by 1885, he's published something that people have heard of called Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And from 1885 until his death in 1910, he publishes three or four more books and lots of short things, and becomes one of the most famous writers that America has ever seen. Mm-hmm. He dies in April of 1910, and that's a thumbnail for you.
I think most of us in what we know of Mark Twain think of him as an utterly unique figure that is writing in a style, sharing insights, viewing his world and those around him in a way utterly unique and completely refreshing for his time. I wonder if that is, in fact, a good way to view him. Or was he one of a number of comparable writers speaking in similarly sort of insightful and fresh ways? Or was he really as much sort of one of a kind as he immediately seems to be?
I think it is the latter. I think you're absolutely right that he, I'm glad that people do think of him that way, because he is in many ways unique. People ask me all the time, who does he derive from? Who does he copy? The fact is, he's really very much unique, someone who has his own talents and doesn't really copy anybody. At the same time, when he's beginning to do all this in the 60s and 70s, there are all kinds of American humorists out there, people like Artemus Ward, Petroleum V. Natsby, people you've never heard of, because they disappear. They don't last. But Mark Twain's humor is so good that it outlasts every one of those competing humorists. He is someone who is famous at his own time and has remained famous for at least 100 years.
I want to just mention this parenthetically because I'm afraid I'll forget. And I suppose in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter all that much. But still, I was astonished when I opened up the book and saw the photograph of Mark Twain opposite the title page. I mean, for its time, it's an incredibly vivid, clear photograph.
Yes, Mr.
Twain is sitting on a rocking chair, I presume, on the front porch of his home, and you can literally count the little weaves of the back of his rocking chair, and there is none of the blur that we typically see in a photograph of this vintage. And at first I thought, oh, this has to be Hal Holbrook or somebody, I mean, like a 20th century figure impersonating Mr. Twain. And of course,
well, that has happened, believe me. A number of books have come out with pictures of Hal Holbrook on the back of it that people thought were Mark Twain.
Right. It
wouldn't be unprecedented, I'll say that.
Right.
But you're right. The photograph is remarkably clear. You have to remember that at the time, really so-called Kodak handheld small cameras were just coming into the use. That photograph was taken by his official biographer, Albert Bigelow Payne, on a house that they were renting in New Hampshire. The fact is, even with a handheld camera, the exposure time was quite long. And those of you who know anything about photography know that that increases the depth of field and makes it look and makes it be much sharper than we might get from, let's say, from a telephone, all the little phone cameras that we've got now.
Right. So we look at this photograph, and it makes Mark Twain seem like he's not a figure from a distant age. I mean, this photograph, although it is in black and white, it looks like it could have been taken today. And,
yes, I agree with you.
And in some ways, I appreciate that because, of course, as a writer, he is a similarly vibrant figure. I wonder if we could hear a little bit about the work that you've been doing over the last several decades with the Mark Twain Project, even ahead of the collection of the specific materials that we find in this autobiography of Mark Twain. But in a more overarching way, what has the mission of the Mark Twain Project been and your role within that mission?
Well, I'll try to keep this brief, but you don't have to stop me if I go on too long. Basically, Mark Twain's papers, his private papers, came to the University of California in 1949. They were the gift of his only surviving daughter, Clara. Mark Twain was the kind of writer who kept things. So in that, those batch of papers were 17,000 letters to him, 3,000 letters by him, 50 notebooks, 12 file feet of the autobiography, dozens and dozens, almost 700 literary maps of various kinds and descriptions, close, some finished, some not. And those things were things that we thought finished. And so beginning in 1967, we tried to publish everything we thought the world ought to chance to see. We're working on it. We're about, we're about three-fifths done. It's not just his papers. We're also doing his published works, because all of those have corruption that we would like to get rid of. Most people don't know, for instance, that all of his published works were published with illustrations. Modern publishers don't include them because that's too expensive, but we include them. So our edition of Huckleberry Finn, you'll see the original illustrations, and you'll see a text that is based for the first time on a manuscript, his manuscript, and made as accurate as possible, made as close to what he wanted as we can get it, with notes and explanatory information in the back of the book. So we've got a big project on our hands. Mark Twain wrote an enormous amount. We think he wrote at least 50,000 letters. We still find on the average of 3 letters a week in one place or another. We're going to publish them all, and the idea is to make it available to anyone who wants to read Mark Twain or to reprint him or to in some way study him.
Mm. So for all that you have, for the enormous number of papers and letters and so on, you are still also in the process of gathering up everything that he wrote. I mean, there are still things found. Wow.
That's correct, because you see, letters go out into the world, people keep them, and what's more, they keep them and often don't know, that they don't tell their grandkids that there are, you know, there's a letter in that book up there on the shelf. So people are finding them left and right, you know, the grandkids take the book off the shelf and now full five letters by Mark Twain. Or a library now puts its catalog up online, which means that we can find, if they've cataloged Mark Twain's letters, we can find that very easily and ask them for copies. So, as I say, we're still finding three letters a week. That's a lot of letters, especially since they're wonderful letters.
Of course.
They're not just I can't come to tea letters. You know?
We're speaking with Bob Hurst. We are talking about the autobiography of Mark Twain. Volume 1 has just been published. So one of the most interesting stories here is of Mark Twain's interest in writing an autobiography and of sort of his abortive efforts to do it. I mean, trying sort of several different times before seeming to hit upon a new way of going about this. And a lot of what we read in the autobiography is sort of about the autobiography itself and this sort of torturous process. First of all, part of it seems to be that Mark Twain had a certain attitude about or intention about what the autobiography should be and how it should be written. Can you just say a word about that?
Sure. Actually, quite early, in about 1876, almost 30 years before he settles down and finally produces the autobiography you've got in hand there, he has the basic notions of what this autobiography ought to be like. It ought to be the absolute truth. It should appear without any editing, suppression by his wife or anybody else. And it should feel free to kind of move around and change the subject. But and not be what we would call a kind of cradle-to-grave narrative. He doesn't want to do that. But it's a very hard kind of, genre to give up. I mean, we all think chronologically in many ways. And Mark Twain's experiments, the ones you were referring to, the ones that survive, show that even though he's trying to follow that notion of really just focusing on what interests him at the time, the chronological habit, as it were, persists. And it takes him a while to really reject that. And by the time he starts working on the autobiography in 1904, 1905, and 1906, he's figured out that he can dictate it and that he can change the subject whenever he wants to and not worry about a narrative line. Now, that may be very challenging, but I guess to modern readers, actually, it's less challenging than it would have been to people at the time.
One of the best images I think he himself creates about sort of the difference between a standard narrative biography or autobiography and what he has in mind is when he writes this in one point. Within the last 8 or 10 years, I have made several attempts to do the autobiography in one way or another with a pen, but the results were not satisfactory. It was too literary. With the pen in one's hand, narrative is a difficult art. Narrative should flow as flows the brook down through the hills and the leafy woodlands, its course changed by every boulder it comes across and by every grass-clad gravelly spur that projects into its path, its surface broken, but its course not stayed by rocks and gravel on the bottom and the shoal places. It goes on to say more about that. With pen in hand, the narrative stream so often is a canal. It moves slowly, smoothly, decorously, sleepily. It has no blemish except that it is all blemish. It is too literary, too prim, too nice. And so, right. Of course, if that's the way one likes your biographies or autobiographies, then this is probably not the book for you. But on the other hand, if you enjoy more of an adventure, a freewheeling sort of approach, then readers are going to really delight in this.
I agree with that. I mean, if you come to this expecting it to be a standard biography, really, I was born in Florida, et cetera, et cetera, you'd be terribly disappointed because it's not that. In fact, there is no narrative line whatsoever. He discovers in 1904 that the right way to an autobiography is basically to talk about what you want to talk about, change the subject whenever you feel the least bit bored with it, and go on with the new subject. And so that is literally what he does. These sort of individual dictations that he creates on a daily basis don't have titles. So they really just are known by their dates, January 9th, January 10th, January 11th. And he really literally does talk about whatever he feels of interest in at the time, whether it occurred to him in the newspaper or something he read in the newspaper, or really just something that somebody has said to him. But what you get from that is, it's like having a conversation with Mark Twain, even though he's doing all the talking. You're sitting in his presence, and he is literally talking to you. That is something you cannot get in any of his major works. And it is, I think, quite true that for some people, it's encountering Mark Twain for the first time.
And I think one of the ways in which we have a sense of that is that often he will be talking about something and then, in a sense, takes off on a tangent, the way
exactly.
many of us do in conversation.
Yes.
And it's one more way in which this feels so much like we are overhearing a spontaneous conversation with the man himself.
I agree with that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's part of his impulse to be truthful. You know, I mean, one of the things he feels is that if you lock yourself into this chronological narrative, you're going to be distorting things in order to fit the narrative. So he's willing to kind of put himself on record as just saying what comes to mind at this point or that point. And by and large, if you look at these typescripts, these are typescripts produced by a secretary who took dictation. Relatively few changes are imposed on the typescripts. So he is able to speak in a way which you and I probably can't. I mean, I know I can't. He is able to speak in whole paragraphs that are just remarkably lucid and clear and funny.
Well, that's for sure. That is for sure. One of the matters that's a little bit complicated that maybe you can help explain to us is of how he seems not to have wanted much of what he was writing at the time to be immediately released, certainly not during his lifetime and not even very soon after his death. Tell us what his specific wishes were in this regard.
Well, he basically says, I want this not published until 100 years after my death. Now, this isn't something that one should view as a kind of rigid rule. In fact, his biographer, Payne, publishes a selection from it, you know, just 14 years after his death. The idea of delaying it, of saying it can't be published until I'm dead and long after I'm dead, was to give himself the freedom to say exactly what he wanted to say without worrying about offending anybody. Mark Twain had a rather tender heart. He could be very sharp and very critical of people, but he wasn't interested in hurting their feelings. He says about the autobiography, this is not a revenge record, even though I'm going to be talking about my critical views of several people that I've encountered in my life. And he doesn't want this to hurt their feelings. That's not the point of it. The point of it is to be truthful. And I think, by and large, he succeeds at that. Hmm. Now, it didn't really take 100 years for this to come out because of that stricture. There are all kinds of other things that stood in the way of the publication of the autobiography, but I'm not sure we have time to talk about those.
Well, one thing I would like you to explain is how much of this autobiography has been seen over the years, that is, has been published and released to the public before this much more complete autobiography. I mean, what has the public seen of this material up until now?
Well, let's put it this way. The people who had the opportunity to publish this, they were a man named Albert Bigelow Payne, who was his official biographer, and then a man named Bernard DeVoto, who succeeded Payne, and then a man named Charles Nider, who got access to the manuscript in the late 50s. They all looked at this manuscript and said, this is a terrible way to write an autobiography. No one will want to read this. And so they went in various ways, selected from this, arranged it, rearranged it. Nider, for instance, took the various pieces he had and arranged them in a kind of chronological narrative, exactly the kind of narrative that Mark Twain was trying to get away from. And so people have seen, various three different books that they published, they have seen parts of the autobiography, but they've never seen it arranged as Mark Twain wanted it. In fact, the biography has been in the papers since 1949, and as editors, we have made constant use of it, and anyone who wanted to visit the papers could see it and read it. But the fact is that we didn't understand until really 4 or 5 years ago that Mark Twain had actually finished this. We thought it was an incoherent, partly finished, partly unfinished work that was, in a way, typical of the kind of thing he left behind him. But the editors who I work with, who really do all the hard work, figured out, oh, no, he finished this. He knew exactly how he wanted it to begin, how it was supposed to end, and what was to come in between. So really, we, for the first time, 4 or 5 years ago, began to read the autobiography as Mark Twain intended it. Until then, no one really knew how to do that.
One of the most vexing questions is that of truthfulness, mm-hmm. or the question of to what extent the anecdotes, for instance, that we find here mm-hmm. have been embroidered by Mr. Twain, and we're left to wonder that not only just on our own, but because of some of the things he himself says when it comes Absolutely. To the matter of truth. Help us understand what you would think is the best way to kind of keep this in mind as we read the autobiography.
Well, I would say that the notes that are supplied in the full volume that we published in 2010 and that are also available online in our website free of charge, the notes are designed to address exactly that question. When Mark Twain is talking about Bret Hart, let's say, and saying all kinds of nasty things about him, how much of this is true? How much of it can be documented? Now, it would be one thing if the editors were, you know, constantly shaking their finger at him and saying, oh, no, you got that wrong and this is wrong. We try to avoid that. We try to just give you documentation that can be compared with what he says. So if he claims that such and such is true, here's a quotation from a letter at the time. You yourself can compare them and see how much of it is true. The fact of the matter is, the thing, as far as he's concerned, the thing which makes this a literary work is the fact that he can embroider, the fact that his mind really will not stop short of embroidering. And frankly, that's part of what makes it enjoyable.
One of my favorite little stories in the autobiography concerns the dedication to one of Mark Twain's earliest books. In fact, I'm wondering if it isn't Innocence Abroad.
Yes, it is Innocence Abroad. Yes.
Where he is called to task by someone else for, in a sense, ripping off the dedication as written in a previous work by Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes.
That's correct.
And do you want to share this story with our listeners? It's really interesting, and it's particularly interesting the way Mr. Twain tells it.
Right. Well, the dedication is to his mother. It's very simple and straightforward, and what Mark Twain says is that he had no idea when he wrote this that he was copying anybody else, and it was not until someone pointed it out. I think it was Twitchell, a friend of his, or maybe it was Joe Goodman, who pointed out that it was, in fact, almost a duplicate of what Oliver Wendell Holmes had said in a dedication of one of his books. Mark Twain actually writes to Holmes and apologizes for this, and Holmes writes back and says, really, don't think twice about it. We're all plagiarists, basically, and Mark Twain is part of that school. He says, yeah, you don't always remember where it is you got something or where you got this particular sentence or this particular phrase. There's nothing wrong with that, he says.
There are a couple things he says that I especially appreciate. He says in talking about having brought this to Dr. Holmes' attention and then receiving a letter back, he said, in it, Dr. Holmes laughed the kindest and healingest laugh over the whole matter, which is such a wonderful way to put it.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
And then let me read just a moment further. And at considerable length and in happy phrase, he assured me that there was no crime in unconscious plagiarism, that I committed it every day, that he committed it every day, that every man alive on the earth who writes or speaks commits it every day, and not merely once or twice, but every time he opens his mouth, that all our phrasings are spiritualized shadows cast multitudinously from our reading. that no happy phrase of ours is ever quite original with us. There is nothing of our own in it, except some slight change born of our temperament, character, environment, teachings, and associations. That this slight change differentiates it from another man's manner of saying it, stamps it with our special style, and makes it our own for the time being, all the rest of it being old, moldy, antique, and smelling of the breath of a thousand generations of them that have passed over their teeth before.
The thing I like about that is, of course, it states one thing and refutes it by the way it states it. And the way Mark Twain says that is something that is absolutely unique. You're not going to find anybody else saying it that way.
Absolutely. I mean, that seems to be entirely his own wonderful, refreshing expression.
Absolutely.
Very shortly thereafter, he is talking about Robert Louis Stevenson, and and in the course of this conversation, the name of someone else, a largely forgotten writer by the last name of Davis, comes up in the conversation. And Mark Twain makes such an interesting distinction at this point between a writer who has surface reputation versus a writer who has earned submerged reputation. And isn't that an interesting way of looking at it? Do you want to say a word about this?
Greg, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you. It is a very interesting way. And as a matter of fact, the success, or rather the vast sale of the autobiography in 2010, 2011, is, in my view, a sign that that audience, that submerged audience of Mark Twain's, persists, is still out there. It's a vast audience that doesn't necessarily attend English lectures or, you know, those kinds of, you know, formal things, but is a fan of his, has read almost everything that he ever wrote, and continues to be interested in that. Mark Twain was deeply appreciative of that audience that he had, an audience that he, in fact, literally never met, but that continued to follow him and read him.
Hmm. I want to read the very end of this passage because it's just so wonderful. An author may have a reputation which is confined to the surface and lose it and become pitied, then despised, then forgotten, entirely forgotten. The frequent steps in a surface reputation. A surface reputation, however great, is always mortal and always killable if you go at it right, with pins and needles and quiet, slow poison, not with the club and the tomahawk. But it is a different matter with the submerged reputation, down in the deep water. Once a favorite there, always a favorite. Once beloved, always beloved. Once respected, always respected, honored and believed in. For what the reviewer says never finds its way, down into those placid deeps, nor the newspaper sneers, nor any breath of the winds of slander blowing above. Down there, they never hear of these things. Their idol may be painted clay up there at the surface and fade and waste and crumble and blow away, there being much weather there. But down below, he is gold and adamant and indestructible.
And of course, you know who he's thinking about. Himself. I mean, he knows full well that his reputation is of that kind, and that it's going to last.
And of course, the fact that we are so interested in his autobiography all these years later is a further demonstration of that.
Shows that he's right.
We're speaking with Bob Hurst. He is one of the editors of the autobiography of Mark Twain. He's actually the general editor of the Mark Twain Project, the Mark Twain Papers, and the release of the full autobiography of Mark Twain is the latest effort to share the full, complete writings of Mark Twain with the public. One of the intriguing things about Mark Twain, and probably one of the matters to which people turn first, is to hear what he has to say about African Americans, and of course his perspective is a very, very interesting one, and he speaks with such respect and affection. I wonder if you could tell us what we learn further about Mark Twain's attitudes about those of other aces in this complete autobiography?
Well, among other things, you learn what it was like to grow up in Missouri with family members and his own family and his uncle who owned slaves and who had, those slaves had children. He played with those children. And he said there was really no difference between us, except there was always awareness of this subtle line that separated whites from blacks. But basically he says that's the beginning of my education. That's the beginning of my deep respect for the black race. Now, if you grow up in slave country with your father and mother owning slaves, it's kind of hard to kind of think critically of slavery. And he didn't. He acknowledges that for all of his youth, nobody said anything critical about slavery in his hearing, and he didn't question it himself. But we know that by the time he's moved west, this questioning has begun, and he makes a transformation of himself from what you would have to call a standard Missouri racist to someone who is utterly critical of that, who continues to educate himself about our tendency to kind of categorize people by their skin color for the rest of his life. And of course, by the time he writes Huckleberry Finn in 1885, he's created a masterpiece, his masterpiece, that is one of the rationales of which is to make fun of the racism that has persisted after the Civil War, and that persisted really, I suppose, really to the present day.
He states at one point quite without hesitation, "In my school days, I had no aversion to slavery. I was aware that there was anything wrong about it." No one, and he goes on to say, among other things, that the local paper said nothing against it. The local pulpit taught us that God approved it, that it was a holy thing, and that the doubters need only look in the Bible if he wished to settle his mind. Yep. And he also says, this is what I think is interesting, "In Hannibal, we seldom saw a slave misused. On the farm, never."
Yep.
So in a sense, he is sharing the fact that he was seeing slavery, at least at that point in time, through a particular sort of prism.
Right, a rose-colored glass, if you will. And if you think about Huckleberry Finn, I mean, Huckleberry Finn, the character Huckleberry Finn, also sees nothing wrong with slavery. In fact, he considers himself a criminal because he helps Jim escape. I think that's a clear sign that Mark Twain has, in a certain sense, based Huckleberry Finn on himself. He looks back at his own youth, and he can hardly believe that he believed the kinds of things that he did at the time. So it is about Huckleberry Finn, and a lot of his writings are about freeing yourself from what it is you've been taught by the culture in which you grew up.
Right.
That's not an easy thing to do.
Sure. He seems to indicate that one moment in his childhood when his feelings about slavery began to change came with wasn't something as so much as an incident even, but an instance which involved a young slave boy they had hired there in Hannibal, originally from Maryland. I think his name was Sandy. Do you remember the story that I'm referring to?
Indeed.
Would you share it with our listeners, please?
Well, he talks about the fact that Sandy was a young kid, nothing more than 8 or 9, I think, was constantly singing to himself out loud, and that bothered Sam, and he complained to his mother about it, and his mother said, please don't complain about it. I know that when he's singing to himself, he is not remembering the fact that he's been separated from his family, and Mark Twain realizes that's true, and that he has really no grounds on which to complain about this slight distraction that Sandy gives himself.
The way he describes it is, as I went to my mother and said I couldn't stand it, wouldn't she please shut him up? The tears came into her eyes and her lip trembled, and she said something like this: "Poor thing, when he sings, it shows that he is not remembering, and that comforts me. But when he is still, I am afraid that he is thinking, and I cannot bear it. He will never see his mother again. If he can sing, I must not hinder it, but be thankful for it. If you were older, you would understand me. Then that friendless child's noise would make you glad. I wanted to make sure to read the next two lines. Mark Twain says, it was a simple speech and made up of small words, but it went home, and Sandy's noise was not a trouble to me anymore. She never used large words, but she had a natural gift for making small ones do effective work.
Indeed.
Could Mark Twain be referring to his own writing style here as well? I mean, to what extent is that is that a reflection of how he wrote?
He certainly is. He's basically saying, my instinct for exactly that kind of heartfelt, plain-spoken expression comes from my mother. And we have every reason to believe that that is the case. Her empathy and her eloquence is something that Mark Twain strove to use in all of his literary work.
One other little story I would, this is on a different topic now, but this strikes me as one of many instances in the autobiography where this feels entirely real, because it is not any sort of outrageous event or,
trivial things, right?
That his discerning eye sees as interesting. And I'm just going to insert this parenthetically. I think some people, when they read Mark Twain, they think of the current writer, David Sedaris, and I don't know if you're aware of his work, but of course...
I am, yes.
Yeah, and of course, he spins all kinds of fantastic yarns, and if you enjoy his work, you don't even care about the fact that surely lots of it, in fact, is not really true.
Exactly.
And so I think some people, as they read Mark Twain, see him as the David Sedaris of another age or something, but then we come across little stories like this, and it isn't the same kind of thing at all. It's a trivial moment made not trivial by his observations. What I'm thinking in this particular case is of a story he tells about John Hay, at one point, I believe, the Secretary of State, and a story that involved, first of all, his great courage, but on the other hand, his relationship with his wife. Would you mind sharing this story with our listeners? I mean, it's interesting in and of itself, but it's also interesting in how Mark Twain found it interesting and took the time to share this story with us.
Well, I really am hesitant to paraphrase Mark Twain, especially from memory. Much rather you read it, but by way of introduction, John Hay is someone who Mark Twain knows from early manhood. They both grew up on the Mississippi River, Hay in Illinois and Clemens across the river in Missouri, and they both had an impulse to make use of the vernacular in literary works. And so they have this long friendship that goes on between them, and the story you're referring to has to do with a time after Hay gets married, and I think is living in Cleveland, and Clemens is visiting him on a Sunday. And they're talking together and laughing together about things of mutual interest. And in the door walks Mrs. Hay, who's been to church.
Yes, and I'll read from here.
Please do that.
Yes, the door opened and Mrs. Hay, gravely clad, gloved, bonneted, and just from church, and fragrant with the odors of Presbyterian sanctity, stood in it. We rose to our feet at once, of course, rose through a swiftly falling temperature, a temperature which at the beginning was soft and summer-like, but which was turning our breath and all other damp things to frost crystals by the time we were erect. But we got no opportunity to say the pretty and polite things and offer the homage due. The comely young matron forestalled us. She came forward smileless, with disapproval written all over her face, said most coldly, "Good morning, Mr. Clemens," and passed on and out. There was an embarrassed pause, I may say a very embarrassed pause. If Hay was waiting for me to speak, it was a mistake. I couldn't think of a word. It was soon plain to me that the bottom had fallen out of his vocabulary, too. When I was able to walk, I started toward the door, and Hay, grown gray in a single night, so to speak, limped feebly at my side, making no moan, saying no word. At the door, his ancient courtesy rose and bravely flickered for a moment, then went out. That is to say, he tried to ask me to call again, but at that point, his ancient sincerity rose again, the fiction, and squelched it. Then he tried another remark, and that one he got through with. He said pathetically and apologetically, "She is very strict about Sunday." And then Mr. Twain finishes this: "More than once in these past few years, I have heard admiring and grateful people say, and have said it myself, 'He is not afraid of this whole nation of 80 millions when his duty requires him to do an unpopular thing.' 25 years have gone by since then, and through manifold experiences, I have learned that no one's courage is absolutely perfect, that there is always someone who is able to modify his pluck." That passage says so much about Mark Twain, his gifts as a writer, but even maybe more so, his gifts as an observer of the human condition.
Including an observer of himself. I mean, he knows full well that he has a weakness in that way. We all do, of course. There's always someone who can squelch us, but you try to be brave for most of the time and make that the dominant thing.
Hmm. So this one of the things that's intriguing about this autobiography as we finish up now is that there are famous people from American history whom we encounter in these pages, and also plenty of ordinary people, nameless
Absolutely.
People. And that mixture is really quite intriguing. One thing we should also probably prepare listeners for is the fact that Mr. Twain has some witheringly critical things to say about organized religion, and in particular,
Absolutely.
The way in which some people live their lives according to religious doctrine. And some of those passages are probably not for the faint of heart.
No, absolutely not. In fact, Mark Twain says, when he dictates them, the ones you're thinking of, I think, these can't be published for 500 years, he says, not just 100 years. Because, in fact, he's concerned that if he expresses himself fearlessly and frankly and honestly, he will be shunned. People will disapprove of him. And he says, nothing could persuade me to do that. I'm a social being just like anybody else. I don't want to be shunned. But he's perfectly willing to say these things and have them published long after he's dead.
And, of course, you and those with the Mark Twain Project are helping to make that possible. As we now have in our hands Volume 1 of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, released to the public clear and complete and largely in the form that Mark Twain himself intended. This is now a paperback from the University of California Press in Berkeley. And Bob Hurst, I so appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about this fascinating undertaking. Best wishes to you and your colleagues.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview I recorded just over a week ago with Hope Jaron, a compelling voice around the concern of climate change. And her newest book is called The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. We do spend a few moments at the top of the interview talking about what it is like for her to be living through the COVID-19 crisis in Norway, where she now makes her home. The Morning Show podcast this weekend will feature two fun, diversionary sorts of interviews. On Saturday, Mark Kreidler and his book called Six Good Innings, which explores the spectacular success of a certain town in New England, which at the time of the writing was perhaps the best town in America when it comes to Little League baseball. On Sunday, Beth Lissick's lighthearted look at the self-help movement, her book Helping Me Help Myself. Next week with Morning Show Broadcast, some very interesting offerings. On Monday, you'll be hearing from a psychotherapist with the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, Dr. Beth Rush, who has some very specific suggestions on how we can maintain our mental and emotional well-being through the COVID crisis. And in part two of Monday's Morning Show, a rebroadcast of my interview with the author of a book called A Short History of the American Stomach, kind of a history of Americans and their relationship to food. On Tuesday, I'll be rebroadcasting two conversations that deal with the polio epidemic of the late 1940s and early 1950s in anticipation of a rebroadcast on Tuesday evening on PBS of the outstanding American Experience documentary called